From WXXI News, I'm Evan Dawson. This is Connections. It was 1 year ago today that Rochester police encountered Daniel Prude on the streets of Rochester, and you know what happened next. Daniel Prude died a week later, and no Rochester officers will be charged. But much of the community discussion, especially in recent weeks, has been about how to change how police respond to such calls, or whether police should be responding to such calls at all. And to that end, this hour we talk about what might be coming next. Daniel's Law has been proposed in Albany. It would be a statewide change to how these responses are handled, who's involved, how it's funded, and what would be different if that same call came in again. Let's talk about those lessons learned coming up on Connections.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Sang. A 21-year-old man's being charged in connection with a mass shooting at a supermarket in Boulder, Colorado, yesterday. 10 people were killed. Boulder Police Chief Maris Herold says that by 1:30 this morning, the last person's remains had been removed from the scene, and by 3:59 a.m., the victim's families were notified.
I'm going to read the names of the deceased. Denny Strong, 20 years old. Nevin Stadinsky, 23. Ricky Odds, 25. Trelona Barkanovyak, 49. Suzanne Fountain, 59. Terry Liker, 51. Officer Eric Talley, 51. Kevin Mahoney, 61. Lynn Murray, 62. Jody Waters, 65.
Police have identified the suspect as Ahmad Al-Alawi Alissa. They have not yet uncovered a motive for the attack. The mass shooting in Colorado took place just days after a mass shooting at three spas in Georgia, in which 8 people were killed. Flags of the White House are being lowered to half staff. An oversight committee is questioning the way AstraZeneca released the results of a large efficacy study of its COVID-19 vaccine. Here's NPR's Joe Palca.
AstraZeneca said on Monday that its vaccine had an efficacy of 79% in preventing COVID disease. The company said that number was based on a study of 32,000 volunteers conducted primarily in the United States. Now, the committee charged with reviewing the data collected from those volunteers has said it has concerns about that number. The committee said, quote, AstraZeneca may have included outdated information from that trial, which may have provided an incomplete view of the efficacy data. AstraZeneca responded in a statement that their numbers were based on data collected through February 17th and said they would share an updated analysis by later in the week. Joe Palca, NPR News.
Members of Congress are hearing this hour from Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and Fed Chair Jerome Powell about how the economy's weathered the coronavirus pandemic. NPR's Scott Horsley.
Major stock indexes hit their pandemic low points a year ago today, as much of the economy was shut down in a desperate effort to slow the spread of the pandemic. In the year since, stocks have come roaring back, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average soaring 80% and the Nasdaq more than doubling. In prepared testimony for today's hearing, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell credits swift and vigorous action by Congress and the central bank for helping to avoid an even more crippling downturn. While the economic situation is much improved, Powell cautions the recovery is far from complete, and he promises the central bank will continue to support the economy, quote, for as long as it takes. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, now airing a new season on state policy innovation in America on Pew's podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact.
This is WXXI News. I'm Beth Adams. Good afternoon. Black Lives Matter activists are marching through the streets of Rochester today as they mark the one-year anniversary of Daniel Prude's ultimately fatal encounter with city police. Chanting "No Justice, No Peace," about 100 people first gathered at Parcel 5, and then they walked to the RTS bus station on St. Paul Street. WXXI's Raquel Stephen has been at the scene of the protest since it started.
I asked one of the co-leaders of Free the People Rock why the RTS bus station, and he said, you know, in order for us to get their attention, we have to disrupt the cash flow. And since the RTS bus station is a major artery in the cash flow of the city, they decided to go to RTS bus station and then made their way to Wegmans on East Avenue, where they locked the doors and wouldn't let customers in until protesters leave, and they're still here.
Protesters have set up a table in the Wegmans parking lot, and some of them are writing messages with chalk on the blacktop. They continue calling for the firing of the officers who were involved in Daniel Prude's suffocation during his mental health arrest in March of 2020. He died 1 week later. Organizers say they will celebrate Prude's life tonight on Child Street by eating his favorite foods and dancing to the music he liked. As of today, all New Yorkers who are 50 and older are eligible for a COVID-19 vaccination. The previous cutoff was 60. Governor Andrew Cuomo says the expansion is based on promises from the federal government of more vaccine doses coming in the coming weeks. Our weather today, a mix of clouds and sun, quite mild with a high of 68, partly cloudy tonight, the low 45. And Wednesday, we'll have a few showers and highs in the mid-60s. Find more news at WXXINews.org.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield, encouraging people to make the most of their memberships by setting up online accounts with access to benefits, member card information, and the ability to go paperless. Enrollment online at excellusbcbs.com.
From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 1 year ago today, in the early morning hours, when Rochester police encountered Daniel Prude. His story has been extensively documented, and you probably know it by now. Police surrounded Prude, eventually put a spit sock over his head, held his body against the pavement, and he stopped breathing. Daniel Prude died a week later. 1 year later, what has changed? Today, activists are marching to different parts of the city, as you just heard, calling for change and support. And for months, advocates for change have been working with lawmakers to pass what has become known as Daniel's Law. It would amend public health law in New York State, establishing mental health response units that are trained to de-escalate mental health and substance abuse emergency situations. Instead of sending police officers, the law would establish a system in which those mental health professionals respond to many of those calls instead. The bill quickly gained the support of Rochester-based lawmakers in Albany, including State Senator Samra Brouck and Assemblymember Harry Bronson. What about the PIC team, the Person in Crisis team in Rochester, that city administration leaders have touted? Does this supplement that? Does it replace it? Is it enough? Let's talk about what comes next. Our guests will explain. New York State Senator Samra Brouck, who introduced Daniel's Law, is with us. Senator Brouck, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And in the Assembly, the man who introduced Daniel's Law is Assemblymember Harry Bronson. Assemblymember Bronson, welcome back to the program.
Hello, Evan. Glad to be here.
And Serena Victor is with us, a member of the Black Healers Network of Rochester. Serena, thank you for making the time for the program today.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
I want to ask all three of you just for some opening thoughts before we get to Daniel's Law and what might be changing. As you think about the last year, Samra Brouck, how does the death of Daniel Prude impact your life today?
That's a great question. And I just want to start with honoring just for a moment Daniel Prude and his family, who I've had the chance to speak with several times now over the past year, and just letting them know that we will never forget what happened to Daniel Prude. And honestly, Evan, when you ask how it affects us today, it probably affects almost every decision that I've made as a lawmaker. I'm 2.5 months in, almost 3 months in here, and it's really been a defining marker of my legislative career so far. And I think that looking at what's happening in our community today, it's very clear that these wounds are still very raw, and that folks are not going to give up on trying to change a system that killed this man.
Harry Bronson, how has it changed your life?
Well, I, like the senator, first I want to say to Daniel's family that we're thinking of them today on this anniversary of the killing of Daniel. And, you know, we won't forget. And the reason we're doing this piece of legislation is so that other families will not have to go through what Daniel's family has gone through. And, you know, this, I think, is an extension of what I try to do as a policymaker and as a legislator each and every time I work on a piece of legislation, and that is to ask the question if it's moving us toward equity and equality or removing barriers to equity and equality. And if it's doing one of those, then we're moving in the right direction. We hear about the activists out in the streets. We're hearing their voices. We're listening to them. And it's our obligation, I think, as policymakers to take steps forward to respond to the calls that we're hearing.
Okay. Serena Victor, can you tell me how a year after Daniel Prude's death, it has maybe changed your life or the life of the community you live in?
Absolutely. The death of Daniel Prude has significantly changed my home life, the way I interface with my community and my views upon the function of safety in my community. My heart goes out to the Prude family, first of all, like, you know, everyone else on this call. My heart goes out to the Prude family. Thinking about Daniel's anniversary, the wounds are still fresh within me. And yet it's that very grief that drives me really hard to work on behalf of our community alongside our politicians like Samra Brooke and Harry Bronson and many community members, Free the People Rock, to make sure that we can get this piece of legislation passed so that the lives of our community members can see some semblance of safety that they really need. So I guess the death of Daniel Prude has really pushed me into the avenue, further pushed me into the avenue of advocacy with the tools that I have academically.
Okay. And Serena, you know, listening to some of the activists who have been leading events this morning, starting early in the morning at Parcel 5 and then in marching to various spots in our community, at one point on Parcel 5 this morning, the question of crisis response and mental health response came up. And some of the activists there were saying, chanting essentially that the PIC teams were not enough, that this was insufficient, that more has to be done. When I say PIC, it's PIC, Person in Crisis, and it is a city plan that Mayor Warren has touted that would be designed to send more mental health professionals either with police or sometimes in lieu of the officers based on the needs of the call. Do you see that as sufficient, or do you see Daniel's law as you know, supplementing it? Do you see Daniel's law as needed because not enough has happened locally? How do you sort of see some of these calls for change in various places, Serena?
The way I see Daniel's law is a law that's going to overarch smaller initiatives like the PIC team or the FACET team that currently exist in the format that they're in right now. Daniel's law would ensure, not only here in Rochester, but statewide, right, that a community begins to have some semblance of safety by removing officers as a default to solution to address mental health needs. So with the PIC team right now, and I wish Dr. Layman Torres was on this call because she she's the overarching boss over the PIC team to get more insight on, you know, the barriers that they have and, you know, how effective is it right now? But, you know, it's still in the pilot stages, so it's very hard to tell how successful it's going to be. But with Daniel's law, we're very clear. With the act, we're very clear with the tenants. You know, it's a statewide initiative. It's going to help to, we're going to have councils within each city, and we're going to have councils at the state level. We're going to make sure that it is mental health responders that are responding to crisis calls, and that the mental health responders have all the power to decide on if they deem it fit to have police in their presence or if they can handle the call on their own. So it's definitely a bit more, it's definitely a lot more thought out and thorough in how it's written out and how we hope that it will be implemented.
Well, let me ask the elected leaders who are on the program today to explain their view of the mission of Daniel's Law, how it would work in practice, what it would address to change here. And I'm going to start with Senator Brook here. Can you take our listeners through it to help everyone understand the mission of Daniel's Law?
Absolutely. And I do want to say thank you, Serena, as well, because I think you just did a really, I'm just sitting here nodding. If we were in person, you'd see me aggressively nodding with you, that I think you've really done a great job of capturing how Daniel's Law, which would be a state level law for all of New York State, really how that can work kind of complementary with a lot of the localities and what local cities and counties are already doing. So what Daniel's Law does, and I'm really going to lift up a lot of the language that Serena just used, because I think you did a fantastic job explaining it. It is creating a statewide framework for how to deal with folks that are in a mental health or substance abuse crisis. It removes folks like law enforcement from the first line of response, and it adds in people from a mental health background, mental health providers, people with experience with substance abuse crises. And the entire point of this, is to have people who are especially trained to meet people in these crisis moments. And let's remember, it is to save lives, and it's to make sure that someone with the right training shows up to de-escalate that situation and get this person to get the care and the support they need. So in other words, a simple way of saying it is we're taking kind of a punitive system and coming at it with compassion and care instead. And so I think Serena did a great job of explaining that there are localities who are piloting systems like this, right? Just like PIC here, we've seen crisis intervention teams on a county level. What Daniel's Law allows us to do is create an entire framework statewide. Imagine what it might be like for a locality like the city of Rochester to know that the state has a statewide council, that there are regional councils to back up this work, to make sure that it has things like sustainable funding, to make sure that there is, you know, mandates and processes in place, that they get the resources and the people they need to make those decisions and to really make sure that these systems end up working the way we need them to get to people in crisis. So I see it really as a way to amplify, grow, and really make sure that some of these local programs are working, not necessarily to replace them, but to make sure they have the tools they need to succeed.
Assemblymember Bronson, can you add to that?
Yeah. So, first of all, Daniel's Law was drafted and put together with the help of Free the People Rock, Black Lives Matter, and the New York Civil Liberties Union, including attorneys that handle many mental health pieces of litigation throughout the state. So it was well thought out of. What we wanted to do is to make sure that we had a statewide parameter in which these mental health response units would operate, but we also wanted to have some local control and the ability to tap into local assets that may already exist. So we created the regional councils, both at the state level and in the regional levels. The councils will be made up of mental health professionals, as well as people from the community, so that we're getting the voices of the community. And the overall approach is to move us from a response that is now typically one of force and control, and to move toward one that maximizes consent-based care and services and would minimize the role of law enforcement. So that's the overall approach. The idea is that each one of the units would be certified. So, you know, we would make sure that they're qualified to respond to these types of crises. And the bill also would require that initially, when it would be most appropriate, that it would be the mental health response units that would respond and not law enforcement. Law enforcement would only be called in if the individual undergoing the crisis is at risk of harming another human being.
Yeah, and this it sounds like, Assemblymember Bronson, that we are moving in a direction then of being more specific about knowing who responds to what calls. But here's the kind of email that I get every time we talk about these kinds of proposed changes and mental health crisis responses. Martin just wants to know, be specific. Would this kind of team have showed up for Daniel Prude, or would it still be police? Here's why. Well, I mean, I don't know why Martin's asking that. I mean, I appreciate that, Martin. Let me also say that when we talked about the PIC teams recently, the person in crisis teams in Rochester, one of the points that Councilmember Mary Lupien brought up was that if you look at the case of a 9-year-old girl being pepper sprayed by police in late January, based on the way the PIC teams have been designed, it is entirely possible, if not likely, that it would have been the same response. It would have been police. It would not have been a PIC team. It would not have been mental health professionals. It would have been police. Now the council member has said that city council is working on making a change so that any phone calls to emergency services regarding children, in situations regarding children, require mental health professionals who can help navigate some of these situations because of the failure, for example, of police in the case that we saw with the 9-year-old. But we may not see much change with PIC teams on certain calls. So Martin's asking, what about Daniel Prude? If this happens again under Daniel's law, who shows up? Let me ask all of you to talk about not only what the law is proposing, but what needs to happen. Assemblymember Bronson, can you start?
Absolutely. If this law were in place, I am confident that a mental health response unit would have reported to that scene. And I'm also confident that we would have had a different result. What the bill anticipates is that it would allow the regional councils to develop dispatching approaches. It also offers education and training to dispatchers so that they can better determine what the situation is, so that they can make the best call on whether to send the mental health response unit or send law enforcement or send a combination of both, with the preference being, if it's determined to be a mental health crisis, that it would be the mental health response unit that would go first. And so the elements within the bill anticipates training and working through those logistical issues that have to be addressed in order for us to determine when it is appropriate for mental health response units to report to the scene.
Okay. Senator Brook, can you add to that? Are you confident that we have a pretty good handle on what would be different 1 year later in Daniel Prude's call, for example, or even with the 9-year-old girl who was pepper sprayed by police if this law passes? And you might be on mute, Senator, so I'll ask you to unmute.
I am. Thank you.
That's okay. That's a routine part of hosting a show in a pandemic. No problem.
Oh, it's like you've done this before.
I have. No problem. Go ahead.
So what I was trying to say was, you know, this is the question that we get all the time as well as we are having conversations with other legislators and other community members as we go around educating on this bill. So the thing I really want to make sure people understand, because Daniel's law is an incredibly comprehensive law. There are so many pieces that have gone into this bill, and that is with gratitude and appreciation for the organizers, the mental health practitioners, and NICU that have worked so hard to get it to this place. And because it's so comprehensive, it really has hit on a lot of the things that you just brought up. And so I will lift up some of what Assemblymember Bronson just said. One major piece is we are changing the way we dispatch. We're changing the way we think about emergency calls. So when we think about training dispatchers, there are going to be potentially new questions that they ask to better assess an emergency situation. And when we can make sure that people like social workers, like peer advocates, like mental health professionals, therapists, counselors, when they are in these rooms, because again, they will be part of these councils, regional and statewide, they get to help train dispatchers on the questions that are being asked so that we have a better understanding of what an emergency situation is like, and that will also give us better information to make sure that these mental health response units are showing up. So I want to be clear on that, because I think that the bill, you know, there's a lot of pieces in it, and this is one of those key pieces where it's not just that we're saying call 911 the way you always would, but someone else will come. That entire call system will look different, you know, and the dispatchers will be trained differently. And that is part of the equation that helps us make sure, and why I think Assemblymember Bronson and myself are feeling confident that with Daniel's Law fully enacted, if a situation like this were to happen again, a gentleman is naked in the cold, in the street, suffering from a substance abuse and mental health crisis, that yes, the right people in these mental health response units would have come to get him the care he needed and hopefully would not have led to him losing his life. And so I think that is the key piece that I want to make sure that I add in here as to how we want to ensure that the right people are getting there.
By the way, remind listeners, Senator Brooke, Daniel's Law, what have your colleagues said about it? How have you found the reception to be?
So we are actively, it's the middle of budget season, but we are actively promoting and advocating for it. But one thing I will say is that it's been very encouraging that at this point it has bipartisan support. And I think that that is huge. Senator Helming was one of our first co-sponsors on this bill, and we've gotten a chance to speak about it. And I am now going through speaking with a number of my colleagues around it. And I think that tells you that we have gotten to a point where no matter what side of the aisle, no matter if you live in the city of Rochester or in Monroe County or in neighboring counties, you realize that there is a need for change and comprehensive change. And so that makes me hopeful that on the Senate side, we're able to keep moving this forward.
Now, Serena Victor, as you hear the descriptions of what might change in, you know, in a situation like Daniel Prude's again today, are you satisfied is not the right word, or maybe it is. I mean, do you feel that this is enough to make the kinds of change to in responding to the mental health crises that we see in our community at times, to do it effectively, to do it appropriately, to do it safely? Is this enough?
So when I hear the word enough, I liken it to the word permanence, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. When situations like this, when we're drafting laws, when we're drafting situations that respond to public health issues rather than lumping things as safety issues, I'm thinking of impermanence. Like there is no destination. There is no adequate destination that we can get to. But we're always in a transition. So we're trying to move towards impermanence, meaning that we need to switch the language from safety issues, so the police are called in, versus it's a public health issue, so we need mental health responders to come in. So it's not a fixed thing. Daniel's Law is not fixed, right? It's not going to solve every little nook and cranny of a situation and problem. But it does offer us hope as an overarching and a beginning, a foundational law that we can continue to build upon, right? So that's where the impermanence part comes in. So in that sense, I'm very hopeful that we can train our community members to respond to mental health crisis as public health issues, that we can that our dispatching systems can be trained to see issues of this magnitude to say, hey, it's a public health issue, therefore, what do I need to do with being trauma-informed? Obviously, you'll be trauma-informed with understanding what de-escalation looks like. They will have a better lens to judge, okay, this is an issue that requires me to call the appropriate trained personnel, which would be mental health professionals, versus it's not a safety issue where police need to be involved. So even in that, we're going to have to do a lot of retraining, reprogramming of how we see policing and public safety right now versus public health issues. Right. So all these tenants need to be added in. And so it's going to be an overhaul, a long haul. It's going to be all hands on deck. Thank you that you're having us on your show, Evans, because this then helps your listeners to understand and begin to grapple with what public health issues look like, what public safety looks like involving police, involving mental health workers. And we have a good framework, right? We have hope to know that Daniel's Law can and will be successful, because we look at Eugene, Oregon, who have the CAHOOTS model. Mm-hmm. It's been used for 30 years. And for those who are evidence-based and love evidence-based and love research, so we have something, a shining example of how we can literally replace police as first responders with mental health professionals, with peer responders, and people in the nursing department, and even in emergency response units and everything of that nature. And so they've done it for 30 years quite successfully. And even police in Eugene, Oregon are like, wow, this is something taken off. This weight has been taken off of from their offices, right, and put on the backs of the right people that have been trained to do this work appropriately. And so, you know, this offers us hope to say, if Eugene, Oregon can get it right, and this is a predominantly white community, we can generalize that research and know that Daniel's Law can fit our people and what our community needs. So not necessarily satisfaction, but also understanding that this is an impermanent situation, yet we know that this law offers us a lot of hope and a lot of foundation to build something that looks different.
Well, we're talking to Serena Victor, who's a member of the Black Healers Network of Rochester, and two local elected leaders who have introduced Daniel's Law in their various chambers of the New York State legislature. Senator Somra Brook, Assemblymember Harry Brunson. Daniel's Law would make significant changes to the way we can expect mental health calls to be responded to. Yes, the likes of which we see in the call that led to the death of Daniel Prude, but also other calls, so many other calls in our community. After we take this only break of the hour, we'll address some questions from listeners. Ryan has emailed to ask, when do your guests think it is appropriate to send police officers to an emergency call? Our guests can address Ryan's email on the other side of this, and we will continue with them after this only break of the hour. Coming up in our next hour, a conversation with a photographer and a journalist who have tried to tell the story of the pandemic in their city with their art. It's a look at front porches and the way we have been so disconnected by the pandemic, and the way our front porches became essential places of visiting for family and friends and neighbors. Their story, next hour on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Senator Somra Brook, Ryan emails the program saying, when do your guests think it is appropriate to send police officers to emergency calls?
I think there's probably two answers to that. The first is, you know, I do want to be clear in terms of what Daniel's Law will put forward, which is sending, of course, as we've talked about, sending mental health professionals, social workers, counselors, people who are very well versed and trained in de-escalation, right? I've got nurses in my family. I've got psychiatric nurses in my family. And they talk about, you know, they share stories of when they've needed to de-escalate a situation. And frankly, with people who are sometimes 2-3 times their size, who are in acute mental health crisis. So let's be clear that we are sending professionals. In other words, people who have done this for a living and are simply, you know, changing the setting to perhaps being outside versus being in a facility. And so so that maintains. However, in the bill as well, we do outline that if it is assessed that there is an immediate danger and you know, we can give you the exact language, but essentially there is the option if it is, you know, if it necessitates having law enforcement there. So I want to be clear that does exist in the bill. And then I also think it's important to create context here. And I know that, you know, we've seen a lot of numbers from calls for RPD. And we see that by and large, a vast majority of calls are for nonviolent offenses. And so I think we also have to really be aware that most of these calls will not end up being violent, and the data bears that out. And so I think it's important that we understand it's probably a very small number of calls we're talking about here, and that, you know, this bill really does account for the different needs that a case like this might have.
Okay. Assemblymember Brunson, when do you think it's appropriate to send police officers to emergency calls?
Well, I think Senator Brooke really explained it well. The bill is set up, and what we want to have happen is when there's a mental health or a substance abuse crisis, that these mental health response units show up first. They are going to be trained individuals. The units are going to be certified. So we know that they have undergone the training and the preparation and the cultural competency as well to be able to show up to the scene and handle the scene. When law enforcement is needed is if an individual is suspected of harming another person. The bill specifically lays it out. That's a transformative change in the existing way that we deal with these crises. And the preference is that we go with the mental health professionals who, again, are well-trained, are people who know how to move toward de-escalation, know how to calm individuals down when they're in crisis, and really just know how to handle the situation, where law enforcement does not have that training. And law enforcement is an approach of control and force, where mental health response is one of treatment, compassion, and care. So there will be times where law enforcement will need to show up, but it would be limited to a scenario where the individual undergoing the crisis is at risk of harming another human being.
Okay. Serena Victor, how would you respond to Ryan's email on when it's appropriate to send police? Are you there, Serena? We might be on mute as well here.
Yes. Thank you for that.
No problem.
Yes. I'm grappling with this question, but what I know how to be is nothing but truthful. So my response for that would be, I would hope that armed men who are not primarily trained in de-escalating mental health issues and issues that are of nonviolent offenses are not called in to facilitate or even show up to these spaces where such things are happening. That would be my perfect scenario, that we wouldn't send armed men. My perfect scenario actually would be that police would be de-armed and that they would mirror other countries like the UK or England. You know, I'm getting my countries mixed up here, or South Africa, where police interface with communities all the time, but they're not harmed. So they don't pose a threat to their communities, first of all. So I think it's all about shifting our narrative. It's all about shifting our mindset around what we consider policing to be and what it looks like. Because we can't run away from the fact, Evan, that policing historically came from slave patrolling, and it evolved into what policing is today. So there's always going to be that tension between such specific communities with our police. Does it make sense? And so I grapple with this question to say, when should police ever be called? And then, you know, but yes, in every society that's evolving, you still need to involve tenets that will, you know, comfort everybody, like Senator, like Assemblyman Harry Brunson just said that, you know, in Daniel's law, we've included in there, hey, should police be required because somebody's posing a threat to someone else, they will be called in. But I would also hope that we would look at that statement even through cultural competency and through the lens of trauma-informed, right, less through the foundational historical perspective of how we've seen Black and brown communities and how we interface with Black and brown communities. That's the only community I'm looking at right now, because that's the one that's really harmed by police. And so I continue to grapple with that question as I look to other countries who are doing it in a way that we're not yet doing it here in America. But Eugene offers us hope, and Daniel's law offers us hope in Rochester as well.
Well, and let me ask all of you, and I'll start with you, Serena, on this. Kathy is asking in a note to the show about resources. Kathy says, absolutely agree with everything your guests are saying this hour. But the mental health system is so short-staffed as it is, underfunded in many places, that even if teams respond, Will there be places to bring people? Will there be people to respond? Daniel Prude was released the first time within hours of interfacing with the system. So this is from Kathy, who says, do we have the resources? And if not, what does that mean for responding to these calls? Are you worried about that, Serena?
So I think the resources are there, right? We can't lie to ourselves and say the resources are not there. We live in one of the richest countries in the world, right? And to say that the resources are not there, I don't necessarily ascribe to that belief. And we also have to look beneath the surface to say how was Daniel, as a black man, you know, living in Rochester, serviced when he went to the hospital, right? Was there some implicit bias involved in how he was serviced, right? Had this been a white person from Victor that was at the same institution, would that conversation have gone differently? Would that treatment have gone differently? Did Daniel Prude have insurance? Did he not have insurance? All of those things matter in how our black and brown communities are interfaced with these systems of health, interface with police, interface with social services across the board. And so we have to take a look, we have to dive in a little bit deeper and say, how are these systems interfacing with people of color, rather than are the resources there? Resources are there. We do have the money. We live in one of the richest countries in the world. We do have the resources.
Okay. Assemblymember Bronson.
So I think that Serena's points are very well taken, and we address part of the resource question in the bill, where we know we have a lot of mental health practitioners out there, but we don't have a lot of black and brown mental health practitioners. The bill requires that through working with the state university system, there would be a development of a study to look at the feasibility of offering credit and non-credit courses and strategies to recruit members of underserved communities. So we're there is a mechanism to get not only cultural competency through training, but also to get a more diverse mental health practitioners that would be able to serve on these response units. So that's one resource question. Another resource question is the money, right? And, you know, I have been in the assembly. I'm now in my 11th year, and I'm not proud to say that we as a state have not done a good job of funding mental health programs throughout the state. They have suffered many cuts over many years. The governor vetoed a series of my bills recently under the auspices of having them discussed in the budget. The good news is this year's budget has shifted that trend significantly so that we have more funding toward mental health services overall. Another resource question is, you know, when we're talking, mostly we've been focusing on the actual response and what's happening out there in the field when someone's undergoing a mental health crisis. But this bill isn't just related to that. The statewide council and the regional councils are also supposed to be taking a look at and factoring in what are the other assets in the community. Why are we using emergency rooms all the time after we transport somebody who's had a crisis? The bill anticipates that there could be transport, hopefully consent-based, to other services, whether it is a community-based organization service, it could be a clinic, it could even be, you know, back to the person's home with somebody from the mental health field coming in with follow-up visits. So this really is changing the way we look at how do we provide the services. So, you know, so there's a series of resource questions. The one we've not done a good job on in particular is the funding, but, you know, we're looking to change that. And the bill anticipates mechanisms and strategies to be put in place so that we are serving individuals all the way through and not just responding to the immediate crisis.
Okay. Senator Brook, are you concerned that under the current system, mental health providers are stressed already?
I'm incredibly concerned specifically about our mental health providers and a lot of our essential workers and the trauma and the, you know, we spread them very thin. We have not done a good job of making sure they are paid living wages. And so I want to really go back to something that Serena brought up, that she is absolutely right, right? We live in one of the wealthiest countries. We live in, if not the wealthiest, one of the wealthiest states in the country. And the reason we find ourselves in a situation even questioning how can we provide life-saving care for people who need it and make sure that the people who are providing that care are paid a living wage so that they can support their families is because our state has put through austerity budget after austerity budget, just like Assemblymember Bronson was talking about, that, that they have chosen to make cuts, take beds out of inpatient care, take money out of mental health services, not give cost of living adjustments to people who are doing this incredibly important work. And so, yes, the money is there. And so one thing that I am hopeful for is that this year we are trying our hardest, certainly as legislators, to reject this idea that we are in a moment of austerity and instead really have folks understand that we need to be making these investments because all of this needs to happen together. And when we make the decision that saving a life is worth it, that changing a system that isn't working is worth it, then we get to have the conversation around actually investing in these programs. And so I don't have to repeat, you know, I think Serena was hit the nail on the head. Assemblymember Bronson talked about all the parts of the bill that would allow for this. But at the end of the day, we do need to increase these investments and reject the idea that we can even contemplate cutting further into some of these programs that over the past few decades have been cut. And so so part of that involves making sure we diversify the field, making sure we have well-paying jobs that people want to go into, that they can support their families, right? I think all of that works together. So that's really the only thing I would add, because I think the other two guests did a great job of outlining how this bill can address that.
Talking to local leaders, Somer Brook, Harry Bronson from the New York State Senate and Assembly, respectively, and Serena Victor, who is a member of the Black Healers Network of Rochester, 1 year to the day after Rochester police encountered Daniel Prude on the streets of Rochester. Daniel Prude, of course, died a week later, and the question is, a year later, what have we learned? What comes next? They're talking about Daniel's Law and what it would do. A lot of feedback from listeners. Let me continue with that. Giselle and Geneseo on the phone. Hi, Giselle. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to ask whether in this law they would have the mental health workers wear body cameras, because that could be obviously used to help police officers at least learn about learn a little in case they are called upon is still to do something of this sort, or if the wrong the wrong assessment came in and they send a police officer, at least they'd have some really good videos to look at. And then I had another story, but I thought a small short story if there's time, but I was wondering about that.
Okay. Senator Brook, do you want to take that?
Sure. So I'll break that into two pieces. Thank you so much for calling in, by the way. On one hand, you know, I think what you're talking about is training and making sure that we're spending more hours of the training that officers get around how to deal with these kinds of scenarios, because we have throughout this conversation identified there may be that one to two instance where the mental health response unit may call law enforcement. And I think you're absolutely right. There needs to be a bigger focus on the training of what to do when they get there, right? So I'm supportive of that measure. And on the second one, you know, I don't know if body cam footage is the only way to do that. You know, I think that there's certainly more comprehensive training that should be done. And at least as far as my knowledge, we haven't talked through
adding any sort of stipulation around wearing body cams, certainly not in this bill. But it, you know, that's part of this educational tour of talking about the bill, is really hearing ideas from folks who are on the front lines to better understand what will work best.
Thank you very much, Giselle, and I appreciate that. A lot of calls coming in here. Let me just kind of keep working through. John says, I agree with the ideas of your guests, but I can't see how we can talk about this without recognizing that we live in an armed society. To change the police approach and also mental health services, we need to change gun laws. That's the base of the issue. That's from John. Assemblymember Bronson, what do you think?
Well, I think that's a good point that John raises. I would broaden it not just to gun laws. We have to change the way we think about law enforcement. And Serena mentioned, that law enforcement really is based on slave patrols. And, you know, and that is a focus on control and force. What we need to do with law enforcement is move away from the sole focus of control and force, and move toward a different response of safety and security. I mean, that's the brand of law enforcement. But we really need not only to have that brand, but to really have that focus, that law enforcement is there for the safety and security of citizens, and not for solely the control and the force of citizens.
Jeremy writes to us to say, would you let 911 decide how many trucks are sent to a fire? The fire department sends all resources to a call, sending back those that are deemed unnecessary from the scene. What can we learn from that model? Law enforcement that truly prioritizes public safety would not balk at over-responding or rely on 911 to make the decision on who to send. And he seems to be saying, Jeremy seems to be saying, send mental health, send the people who can deal in different ways, get to the scene and make a decision about what is appropriate, but don't wait to send the professionals who may have the actual training to deal with cases like this. Serena, what do you think? And again, Serena, there you go. Yep,
there we go. I think that's a really good point, especially in how you you helped to reframe the question, in that, like, say, for instance, in the incident of the 9-year-old boy, or the last person that was murdered by RPD, the young man outside of the open door mission, right? If we had dispatched the PIC team and the FACET team together with law enforcement, perhaps there would have been a different outcome, right? And so when we look at Daniel's law, we want things like that. We want autonomy and power given to mental health professionals to be able to decide, okay, we're coming to the scene, and should we need backup from police officers, we will ask for it. Or if police officers are there, you are to be there as second in command, where the sole power is in the hands of the mental health professionals, and they are calling the shots. Police officers are responding to those prompts from the mental health professionals as well. So, but it's also going to require, as Senator Brooke has already mentioned, and Assemblyman Harry Brunson has mentioned, it's going to require a culture shift, even in dispatching, in how these calls are dispatched, even in the language that we're going to use, and even in how we're going to think through the issues of, should I call police or should I call mental health professionals? But I think the default system with all public health issues should be mental health responders first, and then they get to decide upon scene what else they need to be present.
Yeah, and Serena, I'm thinking about John's email. I admit someone smarter than me has probably thought much more deeply about how challenging it is to create a country with 328 million people and millions upon millions of guns, almost a gun for every person by some measures. Most other countries in the world don't have this situation. I am not saying it is ideal. I'm not saying any particular approach is or is not defensible. I am saying, boy, we have flooded our society with arms. And I don't know what that means going forward in trying to recreate public safety, given what we have chosen as a society and how much we have decided that we need to be armed, or that we want to be armed. I don't know, Serena. I mean, I'm not... Mm-hmm. I don't have an answer for that. It is. I think John's point's a fair one, though. It's a complicated problem.
It is a complicated problem, and I think we can look at it. Maybe we can try to compartmentalize the whole gun issue or the whole gun debate, gun law, gun control debate. We can compartmentalize it into box number one, saying why do we as Americans feel the need to have so many guns, mm-hmm. or access to so many guns? That's one. In box number two, we would look at public safety and gun control should not necessarily be interwoven. So when we're talking about the safety of people and the number of guns that people have, I don't know if it's a nuanced situation, but we can't look at it to say, I don't know, maybe the underlying issue is I'm not safe if I don't have my gun in case something happens. I don't know how that fits in. But I think the foundational issue is, I mean, we have to contemplate and introspect individually and maybe as a nation to say, why are we needing to have so many guns? What are we afraid of? Yeah. And maybe what are we bracing ourselves for? So it's a deeper issue. And I think law enforcement and how law enforcement is responding to our communities is probably a clarion call for all of us to say, you know, and then we look at an issue like gun control. You know, hey,
yeah.
Let's introspect here a little. What's going on? What's really going on?
Senator Brook, in our last minute, in fact, less than a minute, let me just squeeze this in. Don says, would mental health responders, and should they be accountable in the same way as we expect police to be accountable, should they have qualified immunity or an accountability board or any of the things that we expect police to have? What do you think, Senator Brook?
I think that's a really interesting point that probably garners more than a 60-second response. But I think that as we reconsider what first responding, what emergency response looks like, we should always have a level of oversight. And why do we do that? We do it to keep people safe. We do it to make sure that we are responding in a way that makes sense and that's supporting and creating safety and compassion and support for people. So I think that that's certainly a bigger conversation, but in that the goal being we want to do the best that we can, we should do that.
Senator Brook, I know time is tight, and on this day marking a year since the encounter that led to the death of Daniel Prude, I want to thank you for making time for the program, and I know you'll keep us updated in the community, updated on Daniel's Law. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you so much.
Assemblymember Harry Bronson, same. I hope you'll keep us updated, and I know we'll talk again soon.
Thank you, Evan.
And we just lost Serena, but I want to thank Serena Victor, who is a member of the Black Healers Network of Rochester, for making time and sharing her insight for the program today. 1 year ago, police encountered Daniel Prude, and so much of the work in the community conversation continues and will continue here in many ways. More connections coming up.